Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Kaya.
Looney Boy.
Wild Weasel.
Is that a segue?
I think it is.
Well, it was till you asked the question.
Oh, yes, it's this one. I see. You know, some of these segues are whoosh, way over my head.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 173. I'm Travis, a.k.a. Wild Weasel, and I'm here with Dan Q.
The guests are in the house!
Jason.
Hello.
Kaya.
Hold me because the sun always shines on Polly.
And Mackie.
It's one of those mornings.
There was a post by Oridan linking to a story on Eurogamer called Sid Meier's Cultural Victory. It's an interesting article. It goes into some of his design philosophy, and I thought it was a really cool article. It talks about his long career. He talks about some of the games he's worked on. I think it's awesome that they call out Covert Action, because I think that's one of my favorite Sid Meier games that nobody else remembers.
I do.
I love Covert Action. When I was at 2K, and I was at 2K for a long time, I really wanted them to do a remake of Covert Action. And I don't think anybody's actually behind that ever, but I know I want it. But it's cool. It also, you know, it talks about pirates. It talks about the new stuff. Has anybody else played Ace Patrol, or am I the only one?
Nope.
I think you're the only one on that one.
Oh, it's so good. Man, Ace Patrol, I'm totally addicted to it. If you have an iPad, download Ace Patrol. It's fun.
I had a chance to look at the article as well, and guess what? Sid also talks about Civ. No.
No, why would he talk about that?
Shocking.
I know. It's crazy, right?
This is actually one of the better interviews I've ever read with Sid. I'm going to say up front, I have to nitpick because, you know, that's what I do. There was one point in the article where he referenced, oh, I talked to somebody in the game industry and he agreed. Blah, 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 he said, and he doesn't actually name the person. But anyway, other than that, it is well woven in between what Chris Dolan, the senior staff writer at Eurogamer, has to say and what Sid has to say. And as Jason was getting at, pretty well spanning Sid's entire career and not just talking about Civilization. At one point, Christian writes, Sid Meier's most famous creation is a series that, as the namely deftly suggests, puts all of human history at your command. It's a procedural reconfiguring of our species' entire experience in which the fate of nations plays out in a million different ways. Although, granted, most of them conclude with Gandhi firing nukes.
Yeah.
So the humor that's in there as well also makes the read more enjoyable. It makes you want to continue reading it because you're not going to be able to adequately read this interview in 2 or 3 minutes, which I would say is about 98% of the interviews ever done with anybody in the gaming industry up to this point in the entire world. I know. I just threw that percentage out there because, you know, 73% of all percentages are completely made up.
I was pretty sure it was all of them.
Oh, Mackie, nothing is absolute. Come on now. Besides, law of averages indicate at some point when you make up a number, it's probably correct. Christian refers to Sid's famous 10 rules of game design, which is a bit of a tease because he actually names 4 of them. Mm. Oh, come on. Make sure the player is having fun, not the designer or the computer. I don't know how we'd measure the computer having fun, but anyway. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. Oh, jeez. Do research after the game is done and double it or cut it by half, which I appreciated Christian explaining a little more, which is when you're in the middle of things, big changes are more useful to a designer than small changes. And this is where he said, I asked a friend who makes games about this one, and he admits he uses it all the time. And it just so happens we have a person who works in the gaming industry as a panelist today. Wow, what a coincidence. Would you agree with that, Jason?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I saw it in action in all the years I worked with Firaxis, but it's also come into play. So I was the producer on Fallout New Vegas. As a general rule, when balancing, you generally want to do double or by half. And actually, I quoted Sid on that many times over the course of Fallout New Vegas.
And just so you know, Jason, you'll be receiving some love letters from Mackie very soon.
Hey. I love that, Dan. It seems I'm just going to start sending random love letters. Sheesh.
I love it. It's okay, Mac. You don't just have to send them to me, you know? No, I'm kidding.
If you're getting ones from me, somebody's stalking you, and it's not me.
Christian says that the man, of course, Sid, is quite a lot like the games. In conversation, Sid's wide-ranging but level-headed, genial but precise. You know, he talks about that the basic challenge of a designer is about being cool. Talks about that whatever's going on the screen, the player, it has to be a stimulus for your imagination. And he says that's part of the reason why turn-based games work in so many ways. You feel like you have the freedom to take whatever time you want to think about the consequences and responsibilities. We still remember that it's important to get the player's total brain engaged and not just the tips of their fingers. First-person shooters. Oh, excuse me. That was completely random.
Dan's apparently never played a game that has stealth in it, because then you have to use your brain.
Kaya agrees with me.
I don't think you should take that as an absolute. I mean, Sid likes first-person shooters and has played them. Sid likes games like Gran Turismo, I think, is one of his favorite games of all time. It doesn't mean that what he's describing is the only way to make games, and Sid is certainly the last person who would say that. This is just his own personal design philosophy.
Exactly, given the types of games that he designs.
Right.
It is mentioned, and I don't think we've ever mentioned it on the show before, and I think it's something that's easy to forget because it's mostly a footnote that the original design for Civilization was real-time rather than turn-based and was a lot closer to SimCity.
Yes.
I want to zone a city in this area. We're going to do agricultural over here. You'd stand back and watch the numbers move. Fun. It really distanced you from the game, though, and at one point we just said, let's try moving the units around and being very clear that everything happened because you did it. If you're behind the game, that's actually not fun at all. You want to be looking forward and anticipating what comes next. I found that comparison interesting because it was being a player of SimCity that got me interested in playing Civilization, and in fact, and I know I've mentioned this on the show before, when I received the original Civilization for the PC, it was grandmother who bought it for me on the recommendation of my parents because they knew I liked SimCity. And I went in with this attitude of there's no way I'm going to find a game more engaging than SimCity. And I have been regretting those words for about 20 years now. Regretting in giant air quotes.
Right.
I had a very similar experience, actually. I first got into Civ 1 when it came bundled with SimCity, and I loved the heck out of SimCity. And then I finally started playing this other game I'd never heard of, and well, 20 years later, here we are.
And yes, to be clear, that's the real original SimCity, not the new SimCity.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
that's all I'm going to say about that.
Trollolo, there we go again.
When I was a kid, I think I played SimCity wrong, because, you know, the way you're supposed to play SimCity is pretty much the way Sid describes, but the way I played it is I played it more like a bunch of building blocks where I would put everything together and then it would send the monsters in. You know, that was the way that I played. I had absolutely no interest in playing it the real way. That was just boring to me. I didn't want to, I guess, sit back and watch the game have fun with itself.
Well, I mean, really, in SimCity, what was the victory condition?
Right.
Right? Because the victory condition kind of implies that this is the way you should be playing, not necessarily the way that you have to play. I mean, perhaps you like to fail on purpose. or incidentally, but without that victory condition, it was so open, it was such an incredible sandbox that, yes, in Civ, there are victory conditions, but probably of all the Civ games that I've played, a single percentage of those have actually gotten to a quote-unquote victory condition, because to me, Civ is about, and it's a reason why Minecraft appeals to me as well, is that it is an open world. It is where you are charting your own course. You can set your own milestones in terms of what you believe is a success or not. You can go back and you can try something different. You know, you can save and you can reload and you can go back in. And that replayability, and in later Civ titles, the ability to mod, not that I've done that personally, but that also extends the longevity and takes that, I want to take this game and I want to reimagine it in a particular way that extends the shelf life of the game. And then when you start thinking about how much has each game of Civ cost me since I purchased the game, and it's probably fractions of a cent at this point, right? Well, you take the total number of games you've played and divide it by how much you've purchased, and you realize, I've really gotten a good deal out of this.
Oh, yeah.
There was one point where Sid believes that he, in being a game designer, picked the right career path. He said, if I was a programmer and I programmed using 1980s technology, I probably couldn't work today. If I was an artist and I could only do what I could in 1980, I probably wouldn't have a job today. I'm still designing with 1980 ideas, and they still kind of work in the 21st century. And I'm thinking, that's... in the 1980s, yes, you would be programming with 1980s technology, but that doesn't preclude the fact that you would upgrade your skills through formal education or just experience. And similarly, if it's the same ideas, yes, but the technology is changing the way that we implement those ideas, because like the new Ace game, once you get on the iPad, you know, on the iOS, the platform that it's delivered on in part is changing because they are trying to reach gamers where they currently are and where they are going to. Two final things. One, Sid made a distinction between education and learning, where education is something else telling you what to think, and learning is expanding your mind on your own to try these things out. So it's not just being able to do something, but to be able to understand why it is that you are doing it. And if you're able to understand why you're doing it, then you can take that knowledge and apply it in a similar but not the same circumstance. So in other words, there is no right answer. There's not even necessarily a right way to approach it, but there's probably a better way to approach it than others. And the other thing is that Civ games are built from history, but they're never bound by it. And this might, in fact, distill down to a very key point about Civ. If there's anything in reality that's not fun, yeah, we change it. If it comes down to a decision between what's realistic and what's fun, we're going to choose the fun path and then rationalize it based on some obscure historical incident.
I'm the Mongols. I should just conquer everything, including the New World, right?
So maybe that's why Gandhi loves nukes.
Well, you see, to me, that kind of approach, it's just like you're writing an essay on something, and then you title it afterwards. You don't put the title on to begin with, because you don't know what it is that you've written. So you wait until you have your view, and then you put the title on it, even though the title is probably the first thing people are going to see, or ought to see.
Yeah, but it's a good approach anyways, because he starts up with some ideas, and then depending on how it goes and whether or not it's actually fun, he takes them off and adapts, which I think is a good approach when you're making games.
Is there anything else from the interview, the first interview we wanted to bring up?
Unless anyone was a really big fan of Floyd of the Jungle, I think we can probably...
I never knew it actually existed until I read this article.
No. I didn't either. And of course, if you know me, I'm reading Floyd of the Jungle. What's the first thought that came to mind, Mackie?
George? Sorry.
Mackie, you sound just like Kaya. That is an incredibly good impression. You should go on tour. Yes, George. So it's Floyd of the Jungle. That should be their... when they redo Floyd of the Jungle, they should get licensing that song.
So the next interview is Sid Meier's We Must Not Forget the Value of the Core Gamer. Wow. I think it's pretty interesting. I think it's right on the spot as well. It says that Sid Meier is considering going mobile but not casual, and the interview talks to him about the evolving gaming landscape and how he's adapting his strategy to this landscape. And it brings up a couple points which I thought were interesting when he says it's just a fact of life that in AAA, in order to compete, you have to have awesome graphics and full multiplayer network support and a seamless interface, etc. And he says there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the proportion of design time versus the time to create all these other pieces. Whereas in iOS mobile devices, you have lots of cool graphics and sounds, but it's not the same time investment to do all that. And you get to spend more time doing actual design, which I think it's interesting. And I think it's something I'm not really comfortable with a lot of newer games, is that they tend to put emphasis on fancy graphics and all that and forget a bit about what actually makes a game good, i.e. solid mechanics and fun gameplay or nice story, depending. And I find it interesting that he says that when you develop games for iOS, you get to actually do that more because you're limited on what you can do graphics-wise, and then you spend more time polishing the other aspects.
I'm with Sid mostly there. I just don't want to take this as Sid saying you've got, you know, the AAA titles, say, for the PC versus the iOS, because we have seen games, and this comes from companies that really don't have a major publisher behind them. So no, they don't have the money, but at the same time, they don't necessarily have the overhead in terms of, you know, executive direction, in the sense that they can focus more on maybe what the iOS generally lends itself to, which is more game design versus having all of the fancy this and the polish that.
Yeah.
So you can have those AAA titles, but fortunately now, not just independent game developers, but portals like Steam, because it's one of those things where these things already always kind of existed, but they were in the background because it was very difficult for them to get an audience, because they had to get in front of an audience too and get comparable, you know, screen time or airtime, what have you, in order to get gamers to be aware of that they existed in the first place and then to explore and engage with that. So you've got that, plus you've also got crowdfunding, which Sid also gets into in the article. And I've got to ask you, Jason, like when Sid was talking about just because you're going for a mobile platform doesn't mean that you're going casual. In other words, you can have those people interested in a game with the depth, like a strategy game, on a platform other than a PC, because you're moving where the gamers are at least some of the time. And I couldn't help but think about for when you were bringing Civilization Revolution to the console platform to give a bit, not saying that there weren't strategy games on the console before Civilization Revolution, but to give a sense of that depth and how you would be able to market it to those people who are on the consoles, but then also take into account interface design and trying to bring in people who are already Civilization players to be able to enjoy that experience too.
It is similar to the Civ Rev thing. I'm definitely curious to see how these two games from Firaxis, and I guess XCOM is coming as well on iPad. It's tough for games to survive on iPad if they're not Angry Birds. and you know, I don't mean that in an insulting way, because Angry Birds is genius. I mean, it's obviously a brilliant game, but it's very difficult for games with more depth to survive on iPad, and especially difficult for games that have a full team like the two Firaxis games did. It's one thing if it's two people working in a basement putting out an iPad game that's very simple design and sells extremely well. It's another thing when you have team working for 6 months. So I'm kind of curious to see how it does. And I mean, I think Ace Patrol is great. I really do. Very pure, very simple Sid Meier design where you get the gameplay in the first 5 minutes and then you spend 6 hours just playing it over and over and over again. And the gameplay is just so easy to grasp and the mechanics themselves are so simple, but it has such charm and it's so much fun. I highly recommend it if you haven't played it yet. I guess I'm the only person on the panel who has.
As opposed to perhaps spending 6 hours trying to learn to play the game?
Exactly.
Before you can start having fun?
You know, there have been successful hardcore strategy games on iPad, but this is Sid. I mean, a Sid game, you just immediately grasp, right? You don't even need... There is a tutorial, but it doesn't take you very long to really understand it. You know, the genius of Sid's designs is... You can see that in Civ, is you're just dropped in this world with a single person, and well, what can I do with this person? Oh, I can move. Wow, I'm moving. That's how you move. And then it just builds from there and gets increasingly more complicated until the next thing you know, you have civilizations at war and, you know, nukes and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But it always starts with just this very, very, very simple action that's super easy to understand. And I'm very curious to see how that does on iPad, where it's really hard to stand out from the noise on that platform.
Yeah, I agree with that. What are the other applications that are successful on iPads, I think, was some of the EA games that have a very specific, let's say, design, air quotes, like The Simpsons. I think this game yielded EA a ridiculous amount of money. I mean, that's a different approach, where on one side you have Sid Meier trying to meet, quote the article, his core audience by making a strategy game on the mobile device. And on the other side, you have another game, which I would call a shovelware, or, you know, the game that you go and play for 10 minutes on the toilet, which basically is what The Simpsons is. It's not even the game. It's just click, click, click on that. It's a different approach, and I'm also curious to see how the two meet. Sid's got one advantage on that, is that turn-based strategy games, I think, are one of the few game types that translate well into, mobile devices and touchscreens in general. It's kind of hard to make a race game and play it on a touchscreen. Sid also touches on the monetization of the game, he says, is against, well, making the player buy additional content or additional features once he has the game. And he's presenting his game like a demo for, I don't know, a short period of time. And once you get a decent sense of whether or not you want to keep playing the game, then you get a one-time purchase, and then you have the full game, which I also kind of agree with. I absolutely despise this type of monetization where you have to consistently buy stuff to keep playing.
And I think Firaxis and 2K have learned something from the experience that is Civilization World, which in a couple of weeks will be shut down, because there are situations where, yes, you could go through and you could work through to particular levels, but there are also other times where you could just go ahead and purchase Civ Bucks, and now you've given yourself an edge in certain capacities. I think that went well over with those people that were already on the Facebook platform, because they could see that, well, this is a more in-depth game, but, oh, look, it shares that particular characteristic as with some other games which I'm familiar with on Facebook. So you're trying to introduce somebody to something new. You try to relate it to something that they're experiencing, but some reason maybe it just didn't capitalize to the extent that 2K wanted. And I know that's been a criticism of Civilization World, the monetization aspect of it, setting aside the outright visceral against Facebook, which I admit I, too, have been guilty of, but when there is another kind of casual Civ beyond, just I'm not talking about the mobile platform, but actually casual Civ, whether or not it will contain a similar degree of monetization. Because I read that same thing from Sid, and I thought, I wonder if that was reinforced, lessons learned from Civ World.
Might very well be. Also, he says that, well, it's just from the article that he's trying to get his share of the mobile market that, according to him, has follows a rise and fall pattern. Well, at the moment, it's rising high. So I guess he just wants a piece of that as well. But he puts emphasis on the fact that, well, he's very much committed to PC gaming and, well, making AAA titles on PC, which I think is good. It's a good read on why his key core audience is still there 20 years after the first Civilization.
And he also wants to have it so that his name carries comparable weight at some point in the mobile market as it does in the PC market. Because if you're just someone who's playing mobile and casual games, if that's been your focus completely or almost entirely, you're probably not as familiar with his name, if at all, as compared to those in the PC platform. I mean, even if you don't play strategy games, even if you're a first-person shooter individual, you've probably heard the name. And since Sid's name is on many of the titles, of course, that this company puts out, that kind of gets people to pay attention. Because you got to be able to capture people's attention first, right? And then you got to be able to keep their attention by the quality of the gameplay.
I actually have a really funny story about that. Back when we were doing focus testing for Civ, we would bring in people for focus tests and show them the game. And before we actually showed them the game, we would talk to them about the names of people they knew in the industry. The most well-known people in the industry were always Will Wright, Shigeru Miyamoto, and Sid Meier. Those tended to be the only people they knew. You know, some people, maybe Todd Howard or somebody else. But there were people who had heard of Sid Meier but didn't know what games he had made. And they would ascribe every game they'd ever heard of to Sid Meier. Very commonly, people thought Sid Meier was the creator of SimCity. We got racing games. We got baseball games. We got he's that guy who made that shooter. We would just like lots and lots. Like, Sid Meier is such a well-known name, and he's just associated with games in general that even if you don't know what it is he's done, you know who he is.
I do find that a little surprising. Actually, not the other names that you mentioned. Will Wright, Mr. SimCity, and Mr. Nintendo. Pleasantly surprises me that they would also know Sid, but then even more surprising that they were associating Sid with almost any game that they can remember.
People got him confused a lot with Peter Molyneux. I mean, it basically the reason is because Sid's name is always above the title. So
true.
So even if you don't remember the specific game, you know that he's that guy who made that game that you saw once. If he must be important because his name is above the title. And, and his name has been above the title of every game since the original Pirates. So, so we're talking 20 plus years at this point. He is the only person who can say that.
I did, and he really wasn't a dismissal, but when Sid talked about crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, whichever term or terms we want to use, and specifically...
Yeah, Kickstarter.
He was polite about it. That's nice for other people, but I don't see it fitting for me.
Well, he makes a very good point, and it kind of goes to the way that he designs games. So Sid will go in expecting to make one kind of game and end up with something totally different, and you can't do that with Kickstarter because you'll have a revolt on your hands. And that's all he's saying. I mean, the games that are most successful on Kickstarter are things that everybody knows exactly what they're getting.
Yes.
Right. You are backing a new version of that game that you used to like. If Sid went on Kickstarter and said, I want to make a new Civ, then yes, people are going to pile on it. But he can't say, I want to make a new Civ, and then halfway through say, you know what, I want it to be turn-based. Because people will just, you know, freak out, and everyone will panic and demand their money back, and chaos will ensue. But that's all he's really saying.
So who knew that so many people knew Sid's identity? Speaking of identities,
we have some identities to reveal. So, finally getting around to the topic of Brave New World, which has been...
Finally, you guys stopped talking about Sid, guys.
I hear there's this game being released soon. I mean,
This editorialization brought to you by Travis's Brain. Okay, yes. You can continue. Sorry. It struck me funny, is all.
I'm just trying to do the segue thing. Earlier this week, the official Civilization Facebook page posted this sort of a teaser image challenging fans to guess the two newly announced civilizations that were actually revealed. Liuji, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, posted a poll for everyone to weigh in on who they thought the next Civ would be. And it seems like the Civ fanatics really nailed it, although I'm sure hindsight may have played a role there. Mm-hmm. Turns out the new Civs were the Moroccans and Indonesians. So we now know, I think, all but two of the...
That's right.
The nine Civs.
Well, maybe 2K was betting on this. I don't know the thought process behind it. But Morocco was very quickly and quite consistently being guessed as the first image. And part of that had to do with some... image editing that people were able to do using these features called brightness and contrast, and were able to reveal quite a bit of the detail.
Yeah.
And they also knew that Firaxis had mentioned that they were catering to some highly requested Civs, so that helped narrow down the focus as well, and then comparing it to paintings and drawings of leaders from the past, and were able to guess Morocco very quickly. Indonesia, however, I think there weren't as many people that were guessing that. People were still happy about it, but the similar efforts with the brightness and contrast weren't as successful. In terms of a funny post, with regards to the Moroccan leader, Hamed Al-Mansour, LDVHL said, I know who it is. It has to be Gorton's Fisherman. So, I'm guessing the Empire is Gortons of Gloucester. Their special ability will be added food and commerce from fish and whale tiles. Their unique building is the freeze dryer, which replaces the hotel and instead gives bonus gold for trade routes. The Gorton's unique unit is the Gorton's fishing boat, which replaces the work boat, but is cheaper. He also has an epic beard, so he has to be in for reals. It's very creative.
Nice.
Now, you know there's going to be a mod for that within a week.
Probably. Well, I mean, there could be a mod for that before Brave New World comes out. Related topic to this video published to YouTube the day before we recorded this from Rev3, and we looked at a preview of Brave New World earlier, which was about half an hour in length, and I actually found this one to be more interesting, even though it was only 5.5 minutes, because as a matter of fact, Zach Miner, who was the person behind the video, he actually got to playtest the game. So he's not just listening to Firaxis or 2K talk about the game, he actually got to play the game, and he played as Morocco. And with regards to Indonesia, he said that other than the capital, Indonesia's first two cities get a bonus in the form of two unique luxury units, and those cities can never be raised. And they're also going to get a replacement for the swordsman, which is Chris Swordsman, K-R-I-S. And we don't know what its special ability is other than increased strength of some description, whether that's in general terms or there's something more specific to that. Not certain, but that's the only thing I came across with regards to Indonesia, characteristics of Morocco.
Unique unit is the Berber cavalry. Well, I don't know what it replaces, but the Berber cavalry. And the unique ability is that they get plus 3 gold and plus 1 culture for international trade routes with other civilization or city-states. And as well, the trade route owners receive plus 2 gold for each trade route sent to Morocco. And they also have a unique building called the Casbah, which I don't know what it does, but unless it rocks, I'm not interested.
I was about to make that joke.
If there isn't at least an achievement for that, then there's...
Yes.
My key approves. No, I think it's some sort of a fortification. Maybe it's a fort replacement. I don't know.
As a matter of fact, the Rev 3 article had Zach hovering over Casbah just for a couple of seconds. And of course, you know, I took a screenshot.
Ooh.
And actually, to tie in to the cavalry, it gets a combat bonus when fighting in desert tiles and in Moroccan territory. And the Casbah can only be built on a desert tile. It provides one additional food, one additional production, one additional gold, and it also provides the same plus 50% defense bonus as a fort. So it does indeed sound like it is a fort replacement that then gives this additional food production and gold. So you can have kind of like a mini Petra there on your hands.
Okay, I'm playing Morocco next time I get my hands on this game. I
think. You realize that what's going to happen is everybody's going to cover their deserts with Casbahs.
Yes.
And as for what the Berber replaces, given its strength is 34, isn't that comparable to cavalry?
Oh, sweet.
So it looks like the difference will be is not in the absolute strength, but rather receiving a combat bonus when fighting in desert tiles and in Moroccan territory.
Hmm. It's a good economic civilization. Let's leave it at that. I'm not sure the unique unit will that much of a... thing, really.
Well, I don't know, because even though it's 34 strength, it says it costs 150 hammers, but a cavalry costs 225.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like the Lanchnet.
I hope it's not available earlier, because already at the discounted price, that's already strong enough. Because even if you're, well, I'm not going to be fighting in Moroccan territory, I'm going on the offensive, I'm not going to have to worry about that, or I don't have any desert tiles, then the fact that that it's cheaper if it comes at the same time as a cavalry is good enough.
Mm. Yeah.
Because even if you're a tech parity with who you're going after, that's going to give you an advantage. You're going to be able to get more of those units out more quickly. Yes, assuming you have horses.
Horses.
Alpha Shard is with us always.
Yeah. I'm wondering how they will modify some of the civs that have comparable focuses, such as Arabia. Because if you compare Morocco with, right now, Arabia, that's sort of weak sauce for Arabia. But hey, we'll see.
I think these were interesting choices for new civs, just from a historical perspective. Looking at the Brave New World lineup, I mean, we've got, you know, another token Mesopotamian civ, a couple more in continental Europe. Bringing the Zulu back, finally.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it seems like Africa and Southeast Asia are two regions that are sort of underrepresented, not just in Civ, but in a lot of games and media. So I think it's interesting that they chose Civs from those regions.
I agree.
Rev 3's Brave New World top 5. Number 1, new Civs equals new toys. No, we've talked about that already. Number 2, reestablishing your cultural identity. And we see some screenshots in terms of the culture overview. We can see your culture. We've talked before about the cultural offense and the cultural defense, that the tourism is the offense and the culture is the defense. You can see a trend. You can see the overall output in terms of numbers. And you can see the level of civilizations overall. The thing that really got my attention that I wish she talked about more, but it was like half a sentence, was this swap great works, which I don't think we'd come across before. And it was on the screen very briefly where it looked like someone having one great work and you having another great work that you could swap it somehow. I'm interested to learn more about that.
I'm just trying to stop the YouTube video to read the tooltip, but I'm failing miserably. This will swapping will exchange your great work or artifact for another civilization great work or artifact. Your item will go into one of their cities, and their item will go into the slot that held the item you traded. An item may only be swapped once a turn. I have no idea what it implies.
You could be swapping every turn. Why do I have this sudden vision of...
shenanigans!
And that definitely sounds like it's coming down to a micromanagement level, which I'm not saying is a bad thing, because there are those people that quite enjoy that. And if you listen to this podcast, you probably enjoy micromanaging to some degree, where it's, no, I don't want the game to decide for me. I can make a better choice.
Yes.
And I'm also willing to invest the time in making that better choice. I think generally speaking, that's fair to say that you can make a better choice, but do you want to spend the time and the energy and the effort to do so?
Yeah.
We also learn about the Writers Guild and the Musicians Guild, that it provides increased great person points toward a great writer or a musician, respectively. Add up to 2 specialists to this building to gain culture and increase the rate of either the great writer or great musician acquisition. It also talked about the archaeology system. We know that's kind of the mid-game. You're able to go to certain tiles that had some sort of significant battle or some other significant event, and you put the archaeologist unit on there, and after a certain number of turn investment, you get a choice. You can either get an artifact, which provide some nominal culture and some nominal tourism, but the landmark improvement seems to be a big culture push, so I guess an artifact would be more like you want to balance a defense and an offense, so that definitely lends itself, I think, more to a cultural victory, whereas the improvement just seems to me more on the defense, so you're not so much going for a cultural victory, and or you're trying to push through some more social policies, because when worked, a landmark provides culture based on its age, plus 1 culture per era older than the Civ's current era, and in either case, the archaeologist will be removed. There was also some things on the World Congress, and it had talked about before that at some point city-states are welcomed into the World Congress, and this screen confirms that it's in the industrial era. As a proposal within the World Congress, if you designate an official world religion or an official world ideology, then civilizations that either follow that ideology or have a majority of their cities in that empire following that religion, get an additional +2 delegates. For religion, the religion spreads 25% faster, and its holy city receives +50% tourism. We also saw, I believe for the first time, a breakdown of the new social policy trees.
Yeah.
In terms of what they give you, aesthetics and exploration, as well as all levels of the order, freedom, and autocracy ideologies, and not just only the names or some names and some benefits, but absolutely all of the benefits. And I think it's more fitting to look at these in a little more detail after the game has been released. So we've had a chance to look at this, plus that this is, you know, some of these things could also still change, subject to change before the game is released still.
Yeah. Personally, there's a lot of unknown still about the overall balance of the game, and I'm not sure this policy tree will mean anything to me right now. But generally speaking, one thing we can talk about is I think there's a trend that they're trying to make the game mechanic quite a lot more in-depth than it was in Gods and Kings and obviously Civ Vanilla, and I'm happy with that. I think it's something that direly was missing in Vanilla Civ 5. And to some extent, Gods and Kings. Very happy to see Brave New World be on the level with the depth level that was in there in Beyond the Sword, to 4, that is.
They do seem to really be focusing on adding a lot of depth and new options to the late game, especially, which I think is good, because, you know, so many times in Civ, you get to the industrial age and it's just kind of like cruising to victory, you know, especially if you go more of a military route. And so I'm really interested in seeing how a lot of these, especially the culture and diplomacy elements, are going to play out towards the late game.
From the rest of the Rev 3 video, number 3 on Zach's list was, it belongs in a museum, thoughts on archaeology, the World Congress giveth, and the World Congress taketh away. And number 5, the number where we try to cram in everything else about the game, which is in less than a minute, by the way. And this is where he says, quote, this is probably the point where you're going to want to freeze frame and enhance. It's very geeky for screenshot analysis, but to me, it's really nerdy when you get into video frame capture, especially stuff that's only on the screen for a fraction of a second. It's like Kaya said, I'm trying to freeze on the tooltip,
yeah.
And I got to go back again and again. Press print screen. Oh, I missed it. Press print screen. Insert explicative here. I missed it. Insert stronger explicative here. And then eventually you get it, and then you realize, How come it took me like 15, 20 minutes to get these four or five screenshots?
Yeah, I think he was just trolling the audience. He could have just, you know, while editing, just released a few screenshots, but no. Let's see. Troll.
He does talk about new wonders, and we do see one, the Borobudur, which gives you +5 faith, must be built in a holy city, and 3 free missionaries appear. But at the same time, they show us a screenshot of the Temple of Artemis being constructed, and then the Chichen Itza tooltip. Your juxtaposition of your voiceover that these are new wonders makes me a little sad. Most people in the gaming community would not pick up on that. Only us hardcore die sivers would even notice it, let alone complain about it. And then on Facebook, James Whitney said, lots of good info, awesome. And for this topic, I think the final word can go to a Jared Gardner, or at least he says that's what his name is. Okay, 2 things. First, be quiet and take my money. And 2, I'll be losing a lot of sleep come July.
Pretty accurate. A thread by Indica Tate. Sorry for murdering your name in advance. And it's called Investigation Penalty for Texts That Are Out of the Era. Basically, this thread says a problem with you or the AI being able to research texts that are way out of your current era compared to the time it is in the game. So an example, he says medieval era starts on 400 AD. Where Renaissance starts in 1400 AD. The AI or the player is on a turn where the date is 1200 AD, i.e. medieval, and he would suggest to fix it by either making texts that are out of your eras not possible to research, or by being able to research them, but with a penalty to beakers. Until, I guess, you get into such a period of time where the tech is relevant. And I think that ties well with what we discussed previously when we talked about Sid, when he said that if it's not fun, we'll take it out. And I think it's just a perfect example of that. Even though I can understand why some people like to play Civ this way, I don't think Civilization is a game of history and a simulation of history. Especially if you're trying the harder difficulty settings, it's not unheard of to have riflemen in like late medieval or even earlier than that. I don't really agree with this post, and I think generally it had a bad reception on the forums as well.
You know, I remember in Civilization IV, right, if you would go down a particular path, a particular branch of the technology tree, then unless you went back and started backfilling, you were going to get hit pretty severely to try to say, oh, you got to be able to balance the trees, right? You can't just bury down one path and then keep going. You can, but you're going to cripple yourself. And now I think it's one of those situations where if you say that if you want to research a tech that's in, you know, a future era as compared to where you are, well, when we talk about you have reached the medieval era, you have reached the Renaissance, the industrial, that's not completely, but for the purposes of the game, arbitrary in some senses. Because you could have civilizations that are, wow, look at how technologically advanced they are in terms of their military. But if you look at, say, oh, I don't know, their economic infrastructure, they could be considerably farther behind someone who doesn't have as very much of a substantial military.
Mm-hmm.
So why should we be crippling someone? And towards what you're saying too, Kaya, it's about making choices. And as far as, you know, in Deka Tale saying, I noticed that the inverse case, you get a research bonus when you're researching older era technologies when you're on the next one or more. I think that goes to, kind of already addressed, you know, the realism point, but from the gameplay aspect, that's looking at a mechanic where the glass is half full as opposed to half empty. Because if you're going out there and saying you are going to get a penalty for this, rather than approaching it that way, then, like they've done, that you are getting a bonus for this. You know, it's like telling someone what they can't do or they shouldn't do, as opposing to telling someone what they can do or should do.
Yeah.
It's just the way that you structure it, and that has in people's mind, whether they realize it or not, it has a psychological impact. If it's a bonus or it's an advantage, you're feeling good about doing something. You're feeling good about the choice you have made rather than getting your wrist slapped.
Yeah. And also, from a reality standpoint as well, since apparently the person who started the threat is very much into it, it also makes sense not to do what he suggests. Because if we take reality, some civilization at the same time word had taken some different advancing paths, i.e. Asia was much in advance compared to Europe in the medieval era. In the game as well, it might show that if you're managing your civilization better than your neighbors, then I guess it makes sense that you get the appropriate rewards, i.e. better tax, better advantages, and so forth. I don't really have an issue with that, honestly.
I just want the game to be fun. I don't care if it has any relation to reality whatsoever. If my swordsman can take down a tank, if my swordsman is strong enough.
Well, there's a line where it has to be fun, but it has to be immersive. I mean, there's a line where fun should not collide with immersion.
Horses killing helicopters is fun. that is still defined, right?
If you're controlling the helicopters, sure.
Yes.
Feels kind of like a penalty for doing well at your research.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too many rules.
I think that at least from the research perspective itself, Civ tends to do a pretty good job of kind of balancing that on its own without having those sort of artificial restrictions, because you know there tend to be certain texts that are more relevant to science and culture and other paths that are more toward military industrialization, and you sort of get in a situation where if you do go too far out one path, you reach a point where it becomes very difficult to really advance because you know part of your empire is suffering. I think that's a better way to go about it than try to fit it to the mold of actual history and just kind of let the game, you know, guide you self.
Yeah.
Back to talking about Civ that isn't Brave New World, to Gods and Kings. I am not going to try and pronounce the Caesar name because I'm going to totally mess it up, but he says that there is a ton of raise versus puppet versus annex threads out there, but he can't find one that addresses his situation specifically. He's taking over the Aztecs. That's what it is. He's coming down to another Aztec city. He likes the spot. It's got two sources of whales, two sources of fish, and with the desert, he can spam trading posts for now. He asked, do settled cities increase the cost of great people like annexed ones do? Because he'd like to puppet and annex later because he's, let's see, well, he's emperor, so he doesn't want to build too many cities. He's in the middle of building the National College right now, and there's no way he can get a settler out there before Darius decides to sneak in. But on the other hand, he's considering raising it because puppets build a lot of stuff because he's only making like plus one a turn, so his economy's like just barely balanced. He won't be able to micromanage it until he can afford to annex it. Since he can't annex it for a while, he can only hope they'll be smart enough to prioritize a lighthouse. Which, yeah, sometimes the AI, nope.
It strikes me that he's not even touching on whether or not he's considering annexing because of the actual production food values of the city. And when you look at it, has no production whatsoever, apart from maybe later with harbors and...
Yeah, there's only like 5 hammers there. Yikes.
Yeah. And he's also short on happiness. And apparently he's going for a rush. So,
And it does look like that this is the final Aztec city as well. So it's not a situation of, well, if I raise it and then move away, the AI might come back in and settle that spot. I suppose another AI could do that down the road, but...
Yeah, you can see in the minimap why he's concerned about Darius, because Darius is just literally to the north of him. As soon as that spot opened up, it'd be like, whoop, settler time!
But at the same time, for the reasons we identified, it's not going to be a very productive city, or to have it any kind of decent, you're going to have to invest a lot in it over an extended period of time. So if Darius is crazy enough to expend the resource to generate a settler and then settle it there, it's really not going to be that big of a challenge, and you can just go in and then raise that city of Darius when you continue down your rush.
Or just take this and annex the city of Darius, which apparently if Darius is selling south, that might work to his advantage more than having a city lost in the coast, not close to anyone. Because when you're rushing like that with the Huns, what you would like to do ideally is have a chain of cities that lead somewhere to another potential target. Not necessarily...
Yeah, it would do him better to have a city up there between Lisbon and where Darius is.
Mm-hmm.
If he really decided he wanted that spot to have a connection between he and Darius, which, yeah, I think Lisbon would be the better choice if he felt he needed something like that, then, I mean, he could take it now, and he could raise it later if he was really so inclined.
Mm-hmm.
And if he did decide to do that, I mean, as soon as it's, would you like to annex or puppet the city? I realize this is earlier on in the game. It's only size 3, but still, you're going to have a number of turns where you're not going to be able to do anything in that city. So I'm trying to think of an exception to this, because at any point you can decide, I don't want you to be a puppet anymore. I want you to annex. Just go ahead and puppet it, so you're not going to take as big a happiness hit, and you wait for it to get out of revolt, and then if you decide at that point, or at some point in the future, okay, I'm in a position where I can make this a bit more of a production house, as opposed to, you know, the gold focus that puppets tend to do, then I'll go ahead and do that in the future. But honestly, I think raising is the best choice, because quality over quantity cities, really, particularly in this early game.
Plus, there's one last point I don't think you or Mackie touched on, is, well, his overall strategy plan. He's gone all out military and if you look at his happiness, he's on 0 right now before taking this city. So that's, I think, another point to take into consideration, is that if he doesn't raise it, he'll have a tougher time continuing with the conquest, which is really what you've got to do when you start going all out military with the Huns like that. You need to wipe some AIs out quickly, otherwise you'll struggle once those AIs catch up. And they will.
I know I see that he's constructing a coliseum for happiness, but I think I do believe I see a desert incense that he hasn't improved yet.
Yeah, but you don't know if he already has incense in his capital. We don't know what he has for happiness yet.
That's true. But if he doesn't already have incense, then he could improve that for that. Or, as a matter of fact, what he could also do is, if he already has that incense, then he could get that. And then if there is another civ, looks like we've got the Dutch on the map, and I think also India.
Mm.
Maybe he could sell it to them for X number 100 of gold. And then, I mean, he's only got 34 gold right now, but it could help him, and he could rush by that Colosseum or some other happiness building.
True, but that grant him a really marginal amount of happiness. And what you also have to consider is, if you look at his science output, 21, with only one city, his capital, and he doesn't have the national college yet, he will want to keep growing in that capital quite quickly. He's going to need the happiness not only for conquering key cities, i.e. capitals and whatnot. At least when I try and do this type of stuff, I wipe them all early and I just keep the capitals most of the time, because you'll be short on happiness. That's, I think, especially true the higher difficulty levels. You can't really afford to keep cities up in the middle of nowhere.
Well, and Teotihuacan is in a bunch of plains, and even more plains. And we can't see what type of terrain he has closer to his own capital. And actually, the more that I look at it, his capital is probably the leftmost city, but there's another city in the center there that we are not seeing. So what is Monty's final city, if he kept it, at least for a little while, would be his fourth city.
He said he'd built a city to the left of there.
Oh, so he has two cities. Yeah.
Two that are his and one that he captured from the Aztecs.
Right.
Because he's saying that city over there could pump out the fishing boats needed.
Yeah, the problem with that is it's going to be a decent gold-producing city in the long run, but Also, the fish as gold sources mean that the city will work high food tiles. And as a puppet, you really don't want that when you're going for mass conquest, because that means you'll be short on happiness most of the time.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I guess we kind of got into the... if he really thought he wanted to keep it, can we... I don't want to use the word rationalize, but can we help him with that if he still decides to go ahead with that?
Does it have a wonder? Yeah, that would be the only reason why I would keep it, I guess.
Now, we can't see Monty's score, but given that it is size 3 and where it's located, I think it's pretty reasonable to conclude that doesn't have a wonder in it.
Yeah, such with only 5 production.
Yeah.
Q&A with the Brave New World team. And people's questions that's in it actually got answered. It's all of 5 questions.
Yeah.
That's,
no one said it was a long Q&A. It's just a Q&A. Yeah.
I know it's the first one more promised, but
well, let's see.
It's kind of like, why don't you come for dessert? All right. And you find out it's like a rice cake or something. Not any dissing rice cakes, but you know, when I think of dessert, that's not what I think of.
It's
one of those desserts where it's just one bite kind of thing.
Yeah, and really not a memorable bite either. Because, I mean, really, the one question about what is the star thing on biology we saw on the other live stream? The star means that the tech allows you to establish an additional international trade route. I'm not really certain that was news, based on previous information that we knew. Or the fourth question, what is the name of unique ability found in the next civ you want to reveal? Sorry, we can't reveal that. It's like, no comment.
However, we have a snippet that doesn't really mean anything to you.
Yeah, what is the strength value? One of the unrevealed units, 34. Okay, it's a cavalry replacement. Woo.
But it might change.
But it might change.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Actually saying nothing at all.
Yeah, it's one of the not yet revealed civs from Europe. So do you mean Europe, your Asian landmass, or cultural European, but located elsewhere? Well, seriously, the answer is yes. What is that?
Culturally European, but located elsewhere. Hong Kong? I don't know.
A country in South America?
You know, for those people in our audience familiar with Turncast, which is cooperative multiplayer and cooperative-ish, I think this is Q&A-ish.
Q&A-ish, yeah.
Plenty of Q, not enough A. Just a lot of questions, but these answers are kind of,
right.
Is that really an answer?
Chat says that there was a debate on the forums that it would maybe be Italy or Venice. Venice sounds,
I don't know. Like a city state.
More like a city state in all the sense of the terms.
Well, in fairness, I can't remember the name of the city state now. I think it was a God and King civ that they had to change some city state names because it was a name of a civ that was now included in the game. So that doesn't necessarily preclude.
Yeah, but it wouldn't make any sense to put Venice. Like, no sense at all.
Send all hate mail, too.
No. I mean, the Civ 5 has a new feature compared to the previous Civs where it was no city-states, and now they put in city-states. And Venice is the definition itself of a city-state. They're running short on European Civs, I guess. Maybe Hungary would make a good contender as well. Not really Italy, even though I would like it, but I'm biased.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Well, all right. Time to go home now. Everybody out of the pool. So that was episode 173 of the Polycast, and that was fun.
Doesn't want
to. Awesome closing. I hate to say goodbye, you know that.
Oh, it's not. We're not saying goodbye. We're just saying so long till next time. But you have to reintroduce everybody, too.
All right. Well, you had the pleasure today to be hearing the pretty voice of Dan Q.
That's not where I thought he was going with that.
Me neither.
Troll.
Polycast is the only culture victory you need.
And there was also Mackie.
Well, we need to keep paying attention to our core listeners, right?
Mm-hmm. There was somebody called Jason.
Thank you guys very much. It's been fun.
And then there was somebody else, I'm sure, though he has been very silent. I think
that might be me.
That might be you, right?
And who is he?
You're asking too much. It's Travis.
On my very first podcast.
Yay! And I've been Kaya.
Topics where we agree with the general theme don't last as long. I agree. No, I agree more. Oh, no. I assure you.
I agree the mostest.
Plus one. Record date, May 18th, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.